Welcome, friends, and first of all, as always, thanks to John Lee Hooker, Carlos Santana, for reminding us about change that's coming. This is Economic Update, a program brought to you every week by the Pacifica Network. Our purpose is to analyze major economic events and trends, the forces shaping our jobs, incomes, taxes, debts, what we buy and what we pay for the goods and services on which we all depend. I am your host, Richard Wolff. I've been a professor of economics all my life at several universities. Currently, I am a visiting professor in the Graduate Program for International Affairs of the New School University in New York City. I also write columns of economic analysis for the website truthout.org, a courageous source of independent news, news analysis, and commentary daily. Please keep sending in your questions and comments. We read each one and select the few we can respond to on the air, but we also use them to shape the programs and the content of our programs. Send them, as always, please, to democracyatwork.info, a website that you will find interesting and that also brings your communications to me. This week, there were more events than I could possibly analyze or present to you. Really was a tough choice. So here's my selection of things I think might be worth your thinking about. First, a materials factory, a factory that produces building materials in Greece, captured an enormous amount of interest this week because the workers there, about 40 of them, in the northern Greek city of Thessaloniki, or Salonika in English, took a step that is going to change Greece and Europe. Greece is a country in extreme economic decline, largely resulting from the economic crisis of the last 5 years, plus the government's response there, which is an extreme form of austerity. And this has produced the highest unemployment rate now in Europe, over 28% at the last count. And workers, instead of waiting, as they have been now for several years, for the unemployment picture to get better, have decided to take some action of their own. After the capitalists abandoned the factory because they could not get the concessions from workers that they wanted and they could not find the market to survive in, so they decided to close this building, a materials factory. The 40 workers in there decided, okay, we're going to run this enterprise ourselves. We're going to get it back into shape, produce the goods and services that we know how to produce, and we'll do it without the supervisors we used to have, without the management levels, without the need to produce profits for absentee capitalists who own shares all over the world. We'll run it for ourselves. And with enormous work, they opened this last week. They're running well. They have orders. It's going to be interesting to follow this concrete example of workers becoming self-directed in their own enterprise. The second item I want to talk about this week has to do with President Obama's State of the Union message and one particularly important economic item raised there and now spreading across the airwaves in a national discussion. It has to do with the minimum wage. Back in the Great Depression, 1938 to be particular, the United States for the first time mandated by law a minimum wage, federal minimum wage, below which nobody engaged in federal activity, that is cross-border between states and so on, could pay less than a certain minimum that was deemed the only decent minimum below which nobody ought to have to work for a living. And we've had a minimum wage ever since, as indeed many countries do. It reached a high in 1968. In 1968, we gave a minimum wage that was higher than it had ever been before, not only in terms of the money that we actually give, the money amount per hour that is the minimum wage, but in terms of what that could afford to buy, what we call the real minimum wage, because you adjust the money that the minimum wage represents by virtue of or in relation to the goods and service prices that a person earning the minimum wage has to pay. So it reached a top in 1968, and I need to tell you what it was. If you adjust for the prices today, then what we had then was the equivalent in 1968 of something close to $10.50 an hour. It's important to keep that number in mind because today, well, let's use last year as an example, 2012, the minimum wage, adjusted for what it is worth now, was $7.25. In other words, in terms of what you could afford to buy with your minimum wage, it was basically declining from 1968 to now, a 40-year period, and there were some ups and downs along the way, but a 40-year period of decline. What does that mean? Well, it means two or three things that are important to keep in mind. First, President Obama said he would like to raise it from the current $7.25 an hour up to $9 an hour between now and 2015. In other words, the president's daring proposal was to raise the minimum wage to something that would still leave it significantly below what it was in 1968. You might call that a modest proposal. It's even modest in relationship to President Obama himself, because during the campaign, his first in 2008, for the first election that he won, he proposed a minimum wage of $9.50, so he's become more modest now even than he was back then. Second thing, millions of Americans are affected by the minimum wage. Not only the several million of our fellow citizens who work and receive $7 an hour, $7.25 an hour, but also many others who get a little bit more than that, but who are paid because they are told by their employer, look, I'm giving you a bit more than the minimum wage. Obviously, if the employer wants to give a bit more than the minimum wage and you raise the minimum wage, then the bit more would also go up. So that a lot of people are affected by the minimum wage, even if they actually get a bit more. Third thing to make sure everyone understands. There are exemptions to the minimum wage. If you are the kind of worker who earns a tip, a bartender, a waiter, a waitress, and so on, you are not under the law for $7.25. Your minimum wage is reduced and drastically to $2.13 because you're assumed to make tips for the rest of it. But, of course, it allows your employer to pay you the stunning amount of $2.13 for an hour. Fourth, let's compare. Do all Americans face a $7.25 minimum wage? Well, there are many states in the United States, last time I looked, about a dozen states in the United States, that feel that that's too low. And so the states have passed laws making a minimum wage in the state that's higher than the $7.25 that the federal government uses. And indeed, you might be interested that the Northwest of the United States is in that regard the most worker-friendly. In the state of Washington, the minimum wage today is $9.19 an hour, not $7.25, the federal. And Oregon is number two, with $8.95 instead of $7.25. There are states that have set a minimum wage lower than the federal, and most of them are in the Deep South. I thought you might be interested also in a piece of information about the country that in many ways is the most successful economy in Europe, and in many ways the closest to that of the United States. and a country that is doing particularly well during this economic crisis, at least compared to the likes of Great Britain, Italy, Spain, France, and the United States. I'm talking about Germany, of course. So I thought you might be interested in the minimum wage situation there. First of all, the country as a whole doesn't have a minimum wage law the way many other countries do. They leave that to bargaining between their highly unionized and organized workforce and employers. But we can tell by looking at what the negotiated minimums are across all the different industries, and by also looking at what several of the states in Germany have done in mandating a minimum wage both for public employees and for any and all industries and enterprises that are helped by the government, which in Germany are most of them. So here, and I've done the work for us, here is what the minimum wage works basically out to be in Germany, 8 euros and a half. Translated in dollars, that would be $11.48. 7.25 is the minimum here. 11.48 is the minimum in Germany. 9.19 is the minimum in Washington State. You might think that if they make a high minimum like that in Washington State or a high minimum like that in Germany, that they would have unemployment, because conservatives like to argue that if you raise the minimum wage, well, then employers are not going to hire the kinds of numbers of people they would have hired if they could have got them cheaper. But you would be wrong. Unemployment is much lower in Germany than it is here, despite the fact that they have a higher minimum wage. So let me turn to that key point. How much you pay a worker and how many workers you hire is dependent on many, many factors. The cost of hiring the worker is only one of those factors. How do we know that? Well, let's do the math. Back in 1968, as I told you, the minimum wage was the equivalent then of what $10.50 an hour would be now. But we had much lower unemployment with that high minimum wage than we have today. Today, the minimum wage has been dropping, as I've told you, for the last 40 years, but we have higher unemployment. So if there's an association between minimum wage and unemployment, it goes to the opposite direction of what conservatives have argued. But of course, it isn't about that. The truth of the matter is how many people you hire and how you pay them is a function of many, many influences. Raising the minimum wage doesn't determine how much employment or unemployment you have. Finally, and perhaps most important, this is a matter more of politics and ethics and morality. Many people like to speak of the United States as governed by a Judeo-Christian moral code. Let me ask you a question. By what moral code would you pay a worker in America for 40 to 50 hours of work a week, $7.25 an hour? If you do the math, assume a person works 40 hours a week, 50 weeks a year, has 2 weeks off. That works out to significantly less than the poverty level in this country. Do we want millions of our fellow citizens to work at that level? You know, by the way, that if you're that poor and you're a full-time worker, you are qualified to get all kinds of government assistance. In effect, what the private employer gets by paying workers that little and often giving them no benefits to boot, that employer is imposing costs on the federal government to help those people because they're paid so little. If the employer paid them better, they would have less reliance on tax-paid social services. Think about it. Think about what it means to condemn families, children born into families that get a minimum wage that low. It is a scandal in our society. Last point. Will there be a few businesses that might not hire as many people if the minimum wage goes up? No doubt there'll be a few. But here's something to think about. The vast majority of corporations, particularly big ones, that are paying the minimum wage for all kinds of service jobs, they are enjoying the ability to pay way lower than they otherwise could afford to pay. The big hotel corporation, the big restaurant corporations, the big home health care providers, they're getting away with paying people the minimum wage they're allowed to. But if the wage went up $1, $2, $3, $4 an hour, they're more than profitable enough to pay all of that. It might eat into some of the high pays of the top salary people, but they could pay, and they would pay, and they wouldn't lay anyone off because they're that profitable. We're subsidizing high profits by allowing corporations to pay extraordinarily low wages. And that's what the minimum wage demand is about. Let me turn to another one. And this one is one that it's a bit of a scandal, but I want to bring it to your attention because I think it raises an interesting question. In France and in Britain over the last several weeks, there has been a scandal around horse meat. If you're not aware of it, in France, it is a long tradition of having two kinds of butchers in the neighborhood, the one that deals in beef, pork, lamb, chicken, and what you're used to, and then another one that specializes in horse meat, which is both legal and regulated and everything else. However, you keep the two things separate. According to the Reuters News Service, now in England and also in France, horse meat has shown up in products marketed as though they contained beef. And not only that, but a recent dispatch late this last week indicated that a good bit of the horse meat has in it a drug called phenylbutazone, which is something provided as a painkiller for racehorses and things like that, and that is dangerous for humans. So now we have the problem that you may be eating horse meat when you think you're having beef, and you may be ingesting a dangerous drug. Many foods, including beef lasagna, hamburgers, hot dogs, including in Britain in the Burger King chain and other outlets, turn out to have horse meat. Why? Because horse meat is cheaper, and if you can market it as beef, you can improve your profits. The profit motive is contributing to a dangerous development in the food industry. And if it can happen in France and England, well, draw your own conclusions. Last week, as we turn in this part of the program to more detailed analysis, last week was characterized by an announcement from the United States Postal System that it is planning on ending the delivery of first-class mail on Saturdays across the United States. That will lay off postal workers in sizable numbers, worsening unemployment in the United States, and it will, of course, affect countless numbers of people and businesses deprived of Saturday delivery. Let's look at what that means and what it represents. It is, of course, part of the austerity regime being imposed here in the United States, as it is in many European countries as well. A program of raising taxes, for example, the payroll taxes that everybody's paying more this year than last year, and at the same time cutting government services, and in this case, Saturday delivery. The post office is a government activity serving the American people, started by Benjamin Franklin back in the origins of our country, and it now competes with private enterprises. And you know them, United Parcel Service, FedEx, and so on. Let's compare the public mail delivery with the private delivery by UPS, FedEx, and so on. The public one was originated and governed throughout its history, right to the present, by a concept of need. We need to have a postal system to keep us connected to one another, to allow grandmothers to send cards to their grandchildren, to allow the local business to reach people who live in rural areas, out-of-the-way areas, slum areas, you name it. You might say that the postal system is governed by need. By comparison, the UPS and FedEx system is driven by profit. One of the first things that will happen with the end of Saturday delivery is that people will have to switch, if they need something delivered on Saturday, from a public to a private enterprise. And that's good for the private enterprise. But it's doubly good because across the board, the price charged for mail delivery by the postal system is lower than the price charged by UPS and FedEx for what they deliver. And that's been true a long time, and there's no mystery about it. Here's the simple logic. The postal system, in order to accomplish what it does, has to pay for the labor it hires, all the workers that process and deliver and collect the mail, and for all the materials those workers need to work with, the trucks, the bags, the sorting machines, and so on. By comparison, UPS, FedEx, and the other private companies, they have to pay not only for labor and not only for materials, but also their price has to be high enough to secure the profits they pay to their top executives in high salaries and to their shareholders in dividends. So that's why the price is higher with the private competitor in this case, and that is often the case. Well, let's go the next step. What about innovation? Do the two sides innovate to become more productive? Sure they do. The post office has updated and improved its machinery. It has let go over 110,000 people in a progressive way worked out by the management and the trade unions that represent postal workers. And indeed, UPS and FedEx have also innovated and used modern technology. But you know, we have a little piece of history that helps understand what that's all about. A few years ago, the Postal Service wanted to run, and did run for a while, an ad campaign pointing out that it was able to deliver mail, packages, letters, and so on at a price significantly lower than UPS and FedEx, showing the American people that they could do better with a public service. FedEx and UPS were outraged by this and went to court to try to get the government stopped. The courts threw out their case, and so they had to go to the United States Congress, where they were able, in the ways corporations are usually able, to get a law banning the United States Post Office from carrying out an ad campaign to teach people the price benefit of using a public system. They were likewise prevented from offering all kinds of services in the post office, like photocopying and so on. In other words, the very private enterprises that love to celebrate competition don't want it from the government and shut it down every chance they get. But the end result will be, as it has been so often, fewer people with good jobs at the post office, more expensive postal services for the majority of American people, and the shutting down of a public service, not because it wasn't inexpensive, not because it wasn't efficient, and not because it wasn't self-sufficient financially. It was. But because it wasn't convenient for folks with big and deep pockets who are driven by the maximization of profits. And there again is an example of the profit motive leading to results that should make us question that motive itself as a driving force of any economic system. I want to turn next to a discussion of the economics of education in the United States today. Many of you have asked about that. We're going to do a little bit, then we're going to have our break in the middle of the program and then return to it. So here are some items in the economics of education that I think you might want to think about. The New York Post recently revealed interesting information about a top-of-the-line private school in New York City. It's called the Dalton School, and it was involved in a bit of a scandal recently about fundraising. That's not the interesting question. But in the course of the reporting that inquiring reporters did, they came up with two pieces of information I wanted to share with you. The Dalton School is a K through 12 primary school. It enrolls about 1,300 children in the Upper East Side, very elegant, luxurious part of New York City, Manhattan. Its alumni include Claire Danes, Chevy Chase, and Anderson Cooper, just to mention a few. The tuition this year, that is the annual cost for your child to go from kindergarten through 12th grade, worked out to an average at that school of $38,710 per child per academic year. To give you an idea of what that might mean for the people working there, we learned that the head of the school, the principal at Dalton, earned in 2010-11, in that academic year, for her position as a principal, $627,308 in salary and benefits. Private school for the elite is very, very expensive. Meanwhile, across the country in public schools, we have cutbacks in the services, in the equipment, in the programs, in the number of teachers, in the quality of the upkeep of the school, and everything else. How is this being understood? How is it being worked out? How is this process to be analyzed? I think what we're seeing across the board in the United States is a ratcheting down of mass education for most people. The public education system is being downsized. One of the reasons people are willing to pay $38,000 a year, and try to imagine K through 12, that's 13 years of paying almost $40,000 a year before your child is thinking about college and all that that costs. I mean, we're talking now that to send a child to a high-quality school at a time when the public education system is being ratcheting down is something that's going to be affordable only by millionaires. And here are some more signs of this. We are pressuring people around the country, pressuring them in public schools, to take these standardized tests. The idea is there's a test we can administer to every student everywhere, one, and we can measure how well they do, and then we can reward the schools where they do well and punish those where they don't. That was never the idea of education. The idea of education was precisely to produce a high-quality education for those who are able to do it because of their income background, because of their parents, because of the commitment to education at home, but even more, to equalize our society, to give everyone an equal chance by providing, even more importantly, the education to the children who come from disadvantaged backgrounds, who don't have the supports at home, who don't have the income at home. Public education was to be the equalizer, give everyone a chance to develop his or her abilities. The tests do the opposite. They reward those who need it least and punish those who need it the most. And that perhaps that's why such a remarkable thing has been going on over recent weeks in Seattle. High school teachers in Seattle are saying no to the spread of standardized tests. Last month, the staff of the Garfield High School in Seattle voted unanimously to refuse to administer the Measures of Academic Progress, MAP, test to their students. They say it destroys the quality of education, the relationship between a teacher and a school and its particular student body, working out ways to provide the public quality education that is everywhere the mandate. I think things are happening in education that we need to look at. And after our short break, we will return to look at it some more.
I don't care what you do, don't care what you say, don't care where you go, or how long you stay. Someday, baby, you ain't gonna worry for me anymore. You take my money and you turn me out, you fill me up with self-doubt. Someday, baby, you ain't no worry for me anymore. Well, baby, eat a ton of dust. You're potentially dangerous and not worthy of trust. Someday, baby, you ain't no worry.
Welcome back to Economic Update. This is Richard Wolff. I want to continue talking about economic changes in education. One of the things that caught my eye recently while researching this topic was a decision made apparently by Governor Rick Scott in Florida, a commission that he has working down there, to allow the state's public universities to start charging undergraduates different tuition rates depending on what major they're deciding to study. Here's the idea. If you were going to study something that Florida employers want more workers in, they'd lower the rate. Whereas if you wanted to study something that Florida employers weren't interested in, you'd have to pay more. What about this? Is Florida the only state? No. North Carolina's new governor has been talking exactly the same thing, and other states are considering it. We are going to organize the education of a person literally down to the price you charge to serve the employer. And let's make no mistake, if we cheapen the cost of education at a time like this, when many students can't afford an education, when many students are worried about the debts they're going into to be able to get an education, you're going to sway an awful lot of people to study engineering or nursing or something where the governor has determined, and we don't really know how, that employers want it, so he's going to give you a price break on your education. We're going to shovel people into those majors. And you know what will happen, as it has happened before? With more and more students studying those topics where they can get a college degree for less money, there'll be more and more of them coming out of there and looking for jobs in Florida doing that kind of work, which the employers will take advantage of by not having to pay as high salaries because there's so many of the students with a major in that degree. Nice move for the employer. And what about the student? Do we want the lifelong decision of what you study, what capacities you have that you develop? Let's be honest. Most young people, 17 and 18 years of age, considering and going to college, don't yet know what their own capacities are that well. They're still developing those. The point of a good college education was to give young people a chance to explore their interests and their capabilities, to take courses in a variety of fields so as to determine what gives them the most satisfaction, what they're the best at, what would make life interesting and exciting. You're shutting that down by telling them you're going to take advantage of the financial mess of the cost of higher education in this country, with unparalleled debts being imposed on young people. You're going to take advantage of that by shunting them into particular majors because you give them a price break. That's good for the employer. It's not good for the mass, the majority of people who deserve an open-ended college education. You don't solve the problem of insufficient jobs for the young people come out of college by grading them into areas before they've known what they themselves want and need. You do it by creating the jobs that should be created for the people who need them, rather than bending and twisting the people to fit into the jobs that employers are willing to offer. Something is wrong with our priorities. And the last thing I want to mention is about something called Massive Open Online Courses, MOOC. It has become an acronym that is discussed in the literature more and more, MOOC, a Massive Open Online Course. That's the fancy name that's come to be applied to all those courses online that you can take. At first, years ago, these were courses in little interesting things people might like to learn when they have a few free hours on an afternoon or an evening or a weekend. Technical things, practical things. Then they started getting interested in maybe having some college course type programs, open courses. Then the universities got involved because this became known as distance learning, a way to deliver college courses to hundreds of thousands of people with one professor doing a course. And that is now proliferating. But I want to raise a question: why? Is the quality of education you're going to get by watching online a better quality education than you would get by sitting in a room with 7, 10, or 20 people intensely interacting with a person during the classroom, before and after the classroom in a variety of ways? Is it going to be better watching, maybe at night after your day work is over, maybe on the weekends competing with what you normally do then? I don't think so. This is not driven by a notion of quality education, hardly. Well then, is it driven by a desire to bring education to large numbers of people? Well, if by education you mean something of much lower quality, yes. And here's something else. If one professor, however well paid, can stand in front of a camera and prepare a course that is now available video, it's certainly going to be much cheaper education, because you don't have to pay for a university where students live and work together and talk together and go through the education process over several years in a kind of intense way with lots of teachers, lots of classroom, and lots of interaction with one another. Face-to-face, all the subtleties of what face-to-face means, all that's gone. But it's much cheaper to deliver a lower quality, different experience. And therein lies the explanation. American capitalism is changing. More and more of our biggest corporations are moving production out of the United States. Why? Because it's cheaper to hire workers in China and India. It's more profitable. And therefore, they don't need and want the kinds of educational apparatus that used to be supported in this country, when corporations felt they needed to have a broad-based education system to provide the workers, the managers, and the executives across the board. They don't need them here. They're more interested in developing them over there, where they charge less money, not just for workers at the bottom, but less for managers and less for their executives. So education needs to be cheapened here, and it is being. And MOOCs, massive open online courses is a way to cheapen the cost of education. Pretty soon our corporations will say, you don't need a degree from a college, really. You can get a degree representing how many of these online courses you've taken. Narrowly focused, non-face-to-face, distance learning. Because it'll be enough for what is needed here. Sure, a lot of the people will not apply themselves. The rate of completion of people who sign up for online courses is very low. Very few stay with it. Fine. That's all the system needs. And the rest of the people will not only be relatively underpaid and relatively unemployed, but relatively less educated. It'll be cheaper for people to pay for it. It'll be cheaper for the universities to provide it. And the educational system we've had is being downsized. And we ought to be very, very concerned. My next economic update, an economic update in detail, is devoted to a question that was stimulated by a remarkable op-ed on the editorial pages of the New York Times on February 11th. It was an op-ed written by R. Russell Rumbaugh. And I want to tell you who he is. He is a veteran of the United States Army. After he completed his Army service, he became an analyst for the Central Intelligence Agency in Washington. And he was also an analyst for the Senate Budget Committee. So with those kinds of qualifications, his op-ed was all the more remarkable. Here's what he wrote. We ought not to pay for the wars we engage in. And he was referencing particularly the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan that are still ongoing. He said we should not pay for them the way we currently do. We ought to pay for them, he said, with taxes. In other words, when the president or the Congress or both together are debating and discussing whether to go to war, they ought to decide not only about shedding the blood of American troops, using up American resources, endangering the lives and civilizations of the countries into which they go, but they also ought to discuss paying for it. The way it works now is the United States wages war and borrows the money to pay for it. Imagine, he asks us, if we decided whether or not to go to war in Iraq and in Afghanistan by saying honestly to the American people, it's going to cost you the lives of sons and daughters, the mental and physical health of sons and daughters, but it's also going to cost you $2,843 a year per family in extra taxes. That would be paying with the national treasure, his phrase, and not only the nation's blood. That's a courageous thing to say, because we all know, don't we, that if we ask the American people about going to war and said to them it's not only a question of military conflict and all of the costs of that in life and injury and treasure, but it's also going to cost each and every one of you, as citizens, so and so many dollars in taxes this year, the next year, and the next year. We might see a questioning of the war and a debate on the war much more intense and realistic than any we've seen. But we don't do that in the United States, hence Mr. Rumbaugh's remarkable op-ed. He thinks we ought to, and so do I. But whether you agree or not, be clear about this, which Mr. Rumbaugh's op-ed brings forward. One of the major causes of the deficit we hear so much about these days, the fact that the government borrowed more money than it raised in taxes to cover its outlays, that one of the largest contributors to the United States deficit was the decision to, on top of our regular defense budget, which is in the hundreds of billions of dollars, to spend hundreds of billion dollars more for wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which the government borrows to pay for. It's something worth thinking about. In this part of our program, I like to talk about a worker self-directed enterprise to bring home the point that these are things happening all around the world, some old, some new. The one that caught my eye this last week is a pizzeria. It's called, or was called, the Upper Crust Pizzeria, and located in Harvard Square, Cambridge, Massachusetts, right near the university there. And it turns out it is about to change its name from the Upper Crust Pizzeria to the Just Crust. And what's interesting about it is that it was a capitalist corporation, actually a chain of about 10 or 12 pizzas, pizza joints, and it got into a legal hassle. In 2009, the Department of Labor mandated that the company pay approximately $340,000 to a number of workers who had not been paid overtime. At least that was their claim. The case was taken by a graduate of the Harvard Law School, Shannon Liss Riordan, who's been working with these workers about it. And so when Upper Crust, partly in reaction to these suits and to the bad publicity, filed for bankruptcy last October, the company closed 10 storefronts. And so the workers had to decide what to do. And here's what they decided to do and why I'm mentioning them. They're reopening the pizzeria as a collective enterprise, something that the workers themselves are going to be owners and directors of, together with another local business, in order to keep it open and in order to show that there's another way to deal with capitalists who behave that way and with the problem of unemployment, whether you're already unemployed or it's looming. Take over the enterprise, run it yourself. Our hats off to the folks at the Just Crust Pizzeria, opening in Harvard Square in a new way for a new future for those folks. Finally, we turn to the questions that you send in and that I want to comment about. And I've picked two from the many that you're sending in. And again, we very much appreciate them. And we use them not only to pick these we respond to, but also to shape the contents of our programs. It's a way for you to participate that we appreciate. Here's this question, came in on the electronics before and from a person who gives us the right to use her name. So I want to thank Peggy Kenny specifically for offering this. Here's her question. While our culture presents democracy and capitalism as two sides of the same coin, are they actually opposed to one another? Wow. Powerful question. Let me try to answer bluntly and briefly because it is so important, and I thank Peggy for sending it in. We are a nation, as are many nations, committed to democracy. And in most places, that seems to mean the opportunity for people who live in a community, a city, a town, a village, a state, a nation, to have political leaders, people who make the important political decisions, accountable. In other words, if you have to live with the decisions of your mayor, your governor, your president, your prime minister, then you ought to be able to select him or her and to make them accountable to you, to remove them if they follow policies you disagree with or are opposed to. If that's your understanding of democracy, and let's stay with that for a minute, then you have to face something that is unavoidable. When you go to work in a private capitalist enterprise, you have to abandon your commitment to democracy upon entering the front door. Let's see why. Most capitalist enterprises are organized either as corporations or as partnerships, and basically have a small number of people at the top who make all the basic decisions. In a corporation, it's a board of directors. Most corporations have boards of directors numbering between 15 and 20 individuals. Most partnerships are also small. The typical capitalist enterprise, large, small, or medium, has a small number of decision makers at the top and a large number of employees below them. If you're a corporation, in addition to the board of directors that makes all the basic decisions every day, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, and what to do with the profits, you have the shareholders. And most of those are a tiny group of people. We call them major shareholders. Shareholding is highly concentrated. In the United States, for example, 1% of shareholders own more than 2/3 of all the shares. Shares are highly concentrated. So a few major shareholders select the board of directors who make all the decisions. In short, when you go to work in a private enterprise that does most of the business in our capitalist world system, you are going into an enterprise where the people who make the decisions are not accountable to the people who have to live with them. The mass of workers will be affected if the company decides to close a factory in one place and move it to another. If the company decides to use a toxic technology that fouls the air, the executives can escape, but the mass of people can't. And when it comes time to distribute the profits, the people at the top make the decision to give those at the top big salaries and to give everybody else as little as they can get away with. In short, the distribution of income in a society, the environmental pollution in a society, the very decision whether jobs will be there or not, are made by a tiny number of people, and all the rest of us have to live with it. That is not only not democratic, it is the opposite. Democracy in politics, in most capitalist societies, is matched by the strict absence of democracy in economics, leading to the following basic political and moral question. How real can the democracy in politics ever be if it's absent from the economy? Well, we see that every day. If the economic system produces, and it's hardly a surprise, a very small core of people with enormous wealth, sitting on top of corporations with enormous profits, while the average person struggles to get by, we know which of these two will most of the time have the preponderant influence on politics. Therefore, our political democracy will be hedged about, limited, constrained by the fact that there is no democracy in economics. Unless, of course, the people decide to use universal suffrage, the right to vote, to use politics to offset the undemocratic nature of the economy. But yes, it's a good question, because capitalism and democracy have a very rocky and conflictual relationship and are not guarantors of one another, not even close. The next question, and final question we'll have time for today, is an interesting theoretical question, and I like to have these from time to time, because beneath all the details that I go through, there are basic theoretical questions. Here's this one. Is labor always the source of value? When profits are made, is it always true that labor was exploited, meaning that workers do not get paid the full value of what they produce? Good question. When workers produce things, think of it this way. Workers working today are obviously helping to produce whatever the output is. But they work together with machines, equipment, and raw materials, about which the following is true. They too were made by workers, only at an earlier time. So both the labor today and the equipment and raw materials that labor today works with were made by workers at one point or another. So all of the ingredients into production today is labor. And so the output, the value of the output, is determined and shaped by the labor, past and present, that goes into producing anything. But from that, it does not follow that the reward, the payout to workers, should be the full value of what they produce. In capitalism, we know that the workers don't get the full value of what they produce, because if they did, the capitalists, those executives at the top, and even more those shareholders who have nothing to do with production, don't lift a hand, don't move a chair, don't even show up at the workplace, ever. How do they get money? Well, some part of what the workers produce, they must not get in order for the folks at the top and the shareholders to get their cut. Now, the point is not that workers should get it all. The point is, if there has to be some set aside for new technology to grow the company, who gets it and who makes the decision? It's exploitation if the workers who make the goods in value can't participate in deciding how to use it. In a worker self-directed enterprise, the workers wouldn't get back the full value of what they produce as individual wages and salaries. They would produce a surplus or a profit too. But the difference is, it wouldn't be other people who get it and decide what to do with it and run the lives of the majority. It would be the workers themselves, acting as their own board of directors, who would get a part of the value they produce, not pay it back as individual wages, but they would collectively decide what to do with it. That's the key issue, and that's why exploitation ends, when the workers are their own directors and no longer give a portion of the value to people other than themselves and other than themselves deciding who to give it to. Thank you again for your attention. I appreciate your listening, and I look forward to talking with you again next week.
Your time now, baby. After a while, going to mine, won't be mine. One of these days, baby, I'm moaning, droning, baby. Try. Won't be long. Thing gonna change. Sometime in the middle of the night, I get so lonely, so lonely, so lonely. Thing gonna change. Thing gonna change. Change. Thing gonna change. Further on up the road, baby.